As we've already mentioned, the 2 Samuel chapter 11, and appreciate Lowell reading those verses for us. We began kind of looking into David's life last week, and it wasn't something that last week's lesson is not necessarily going to be part of this particular lesson, both this morning and tonight, though. As I was studying for this, I realized that there was so much information with what I was trying to bring across that I needed to split this particular lesson into two. And so I decided to do that today. And then in a couple of weeks, we're gonna talk a little bit more about David. And so there'll be four lessons in about 4 weeks on King David. But I think there's a lot in his life that we can look at and learn from. And the title was going to be Lost and Found. And so as I split it, I realized that this part of the lesson is where David is lost. And the second part of the lesson, as we'll look at tonight, is where David was found. We looked last Sunday evening, beginning talking about David as this man of integrity and his dealings with Saul, and it was multiple times that he dealt with Saul and allowed Saul to live, even though it seemed to his men that God had kind of handed Saul over into David's hand to do with what he wanted. And so we find David showing some integrity and saying, you know what? I'm not going to touch the Lord's, and I'm not even going to put my... He felt bad because he cut the piece of his garment off. He felt so bad that he had to go and to address that with Saul and address that with his men and how terrible he felt just for cutting that little piece of fabric. Not that he had killed him, but he cut this little piece of fabric off. Integrity is defined last week practically, maybe not the actual definition, but practically the definition is doing what is right even when no one is watching. My, how we've come a long way in a week, right? As we read 2 Samuel chapter 11 and those first six verses, David with his sin with Bathsheba, imagine how far we've fallen from this person of integrity that we talked about just 1 week ago. Think about the phrase, and we'll come back to it a little bit later on in verse 1 of 2 Samuel 11. But David stayed in Jerusalem. He didn't have to be there. This was the time when kings went out to battle. And again, as you read through that, one of the things that you read about historically is that springtime was really the time to do that, because a lot of times now when people go to war, they're not really affected a whole lot by the weather because they have, you know, certain either vehicles or, airplanes, tanks, things like that, where they stay at a good temperature inside of those things. But we're talking about, you know, foot soldiers, right? People traveling in the dead of winter, and it just wasn't a good time to do that. And so a lot of times the wars would kind of end in the fall as it headed toward winter. And then as it, you know, comes toward spring, then they start going out to battle again. And so we find it being about that particular time, and we find that David stays in Jerusalem. We don't really find Saul doing that all that much. Now again, there's a lot of different commentators that will tell you different things about maybe the reason that David stayed in Jerusalem. And it's not necessarily something that was bad, that he absolutely should have been there. But a lot of times the kings did go out to battle. But we find some of his men in many cases trying to protect David and probably encouraging him. You know what? You sit this one out. You're our king. There's no reason for you to be there. You sit this one out and we'll take care of it. Make sure that you stay safe. But it's in there for a reason. But David stayed in Jerusalem. He could have gone had he chose to do that. We find David now, instead of this man of integrity, we find him inquiring. He actually sent messengers and told those messengers to bring Bathsheba back to him. This is who is described in Acts chapter 13 and verse 22 as a man after God's own heart. And I believe that he's fallen from that. Let's take a look this morning at this man who lost his integrity and see what things that we can of ourselves learn from David. And then maybe the good news tonight about how David was found yet again. We have a tendency to view sin in light of Romans chapter 3 and verse 23, right? We go there and we read this quite often, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We like to view sin in light of Romans chapter 3 and verse 23, right? We are all sinners. So when I commit a sin, I like to include all of you in that sin with me. And I'm not the only one that does this. I'm not the only one who sins. All of those people down at 210 Cedar Avenue, they sin too. That's how we like to look at sin. And it's not true. Romans chapter 3 and verse 23 is absolutely true that all do sin and fall short of the glory of God. But when we sin, I don't believe that that's the time to say, well, everybody does that. It becomes time to own up to those sins. It becomes time to make those sins right with God. We may say, you know what? No, my sin is not worse than anyone else's, or theirs is not worse than mine. We all sin and fall short of the glory of God. But I want you to understand specifically, though, if you look at Exodus chapter 20, Exodus chapter 20, God in His infinite wisdom, now there are hundreds of laws in the Levitical law that God gives to the children of Israel. There's hundreds of them, and we're not going to go through all 100 of them. But what God did was pull out 10 extremely important ones that says, you know what, if you take these 10 and you follow these 10, all of the hundreds of the other ones will just, they'll fall into place. God's 10 commandments. Now, He gave them more laws than this, but these are the ones that He says specifically, listen, you need to stay away from these ones. If you stay away from these ones, all of these other ones will fall into place. In Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13, you shall not murder. You shall not take innocent life. That's number 6 on the list. Number 7 on the list, immediately after that in verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. And then we move to number 10 in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. Anything that is your neighbor's, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, anything, you shall not covet your neighbor. All three of these things David committed. He's fallen from the integrity that we talked about last week, hasn't he? Why do you think it's so important that we be specific when we sin, or that we be specific in talking about the sins that David committed? Well, what I want you to understand is all three of these things, it's important to be specific because all three of them are capital crimes in Israel. They're capital crimes. What does that mean? Well, it means that death is actually an appropriate punishment for the sins that David has committed. I want you to look with me at James chapter 1. James chapter 1, and see how David got here to committing murder, adultery, and coveting his neighbor. In James chapter 1 and verse 13 we find, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and He Himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is accomplished, it brings forth death. We find in these verses that yes, it is our own sin, it is our own desire that causes us to sin. David's own desires led him here, but listen, he was not where he could have been. Right? Do you start to see the lessons for us? David could have been with his men at war. Do you remember what Uriah did when he got home? When David sends for him and brings Uriah home? He didn't even go into his house. And when David addresses him and says, I brought you home, I'm giving you kind of a leave of absence, why wouldn't you go to your wife? He said, I'm not going to go and be with my wife and be with my family while my fellow soldiers are out there fighting and dying. I'll take my rest and then I'll go back. I need to stay focused. Uriah seems to be a man of integrity. Uriah, even being home, knew where he should be or could be. And so he acted accordingly. David could have been at battle. And again, we're not saying David is completely 100% wrong for being at home. I'm certain that there were a lot of other things that maybe we don't even understand as to why he stayed. But he could have been there. God's Word tells us that for a reason in 2 Samuel chapter 11, that David stayed in Jerusalem. That tells me that he could have gone. How often do we put ourselves in a position where we're enticed by our sin or enticed by our lust when we shouldn't even be in this place at all? There's other places where we could be. Think about David on that roof, where he did not remove himself from the situation. When he sees this woman bathing, and again, there's plenty of blame to throw around, right? He sees this woman bathing as he's on his roof, and again, I don't know why he's up there, but he sees her and he doesn't remove himself again from this situation. He doesn't say, well, maybe I better not be up here, I'll wait until this young lady is done bathing. Said it seems that he stays and he watches and he puts himself in this position where his lust, again, as in James chapter 1 and verses 13, 14, and 15 say, we're tempted when we're carried away and enticed by our own lust. Lust is carrying him away at this point, and it's going to conceive itself and it's going to cause him to sin. And that is going to separate him from God, which is that death that it talks about. Not only that, but he also goes further, not just to look, but to go further to involve other people and inquire, hey, who is that? They say, well, whoa, isn't that the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And instead of at that point saying, oh, you know what, you're right, I better leave this alone, he says, bring her to me. And so now he's involving some of his own people. He's involving others. He's involving Bathsheba, who again, we can blame her. There's blame to be cast there. Because I'm sure it would be difficult for her to say no to the king of Israel. All the lessons for us. When we're talking about our sin, and again, I don't know what your lusts, I don't know what your desires are. I just know that your desires are going to carry you away. They're going to entice you. And at some point, if we allow it, it will conceive into sin, and sin separates us from God. Oftentimes when we sin, we're in a place where we don't have to be. We don't need to be there. There may be certain circumstances where, yes, we have to be where we are at that moment. And even if we are, we can remove ourselves from those situations where I feel myself, maybe I've got an issue with anger and I feel myself getting angry. I need to remove myself from that situation. And instead of removing ourselves, we end up diving deeper and going further in and involving others that don't have to be involved. There's so many lessons for us in David's sin where he becomes lost that we too can become lost. But oftentimes it's our own fault because we put ourselves in those situations to be led astray by our own lusts and our own desires. Well, David has committed sin. I want you to understand that when we commit sin, we are going to be convicted of that sin. Convicted is defined as having been declared guilty. At some point, we are going to be declared guilty of that sin. We are going to be convicted of that sin. I've heard or saw this, and I was probably in high school, but the question was, if I were arrested for being a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict me? Right? Where someone would come in and say, yes, there's all this evidence that we compiled. Tony, you are definitely a Christian. Or would they arrest me for being a Christian and say, you know what? We can't really tell. We don't know if you're a Christian or not. We're going to have to let you go. Would there be enough evidence to convict me? Would I be declared guilty of being a Christian? Well, here, we're using it in the sense of sin. David tries to cover up what he's done. In 2 Samuel chapter 11, we continue the account, starting in verse 14, after he realizes that Uriah is not going to do what he wants him to do. It says, now in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. You want to talk about some integrity. This man does not open that letter. That's obvious. He could have said, ooh, I wonder what David is trying to send to the front lines to Joab. But he didn't. David sent this letter with Uriah when he sends him back into the field. He had written in the letter saying, place Uriah in the front of the fiercest battle and withdraw from him so that he may be struck down and die. So it was, as Joab kept watch on the city, that he put Uriah at the place where he knew there were valiant men. The men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell, and Uriah the Hittite also died. Did you catch that? As David is trying to cover up his own sin, did you catch what happened in those verses? There were others, not just Uriah, that died that day. The men of the city went out and fought against Joab, and some of the people among David's servants fell. They didn't trip. These folks died. Why did they die? Because David not only sinned with Bathsheba, but he's trying to cover it up. He wants Uriah to be put to death, but he understands that he can't just put Uriah to death. He's got to put him in a situation where he's going to be killed by the enemy so that it doesn't come back on him. And in doing that, he has to put other people in harm's way as well. You want to talk about falling from integrity? Here's a man who is falling and falling fast. And so now we assume that only David, Bathsheba, and Joab know about Uriah. We know that David sent messengers to Bathsheba, and so they probably at least have some idea of something that went on with Bathsheba. But as far as Uriah is concerned, David, Bathsheba, and Joab know. Now, obviously, David and Bathsheba probably think that it's in their best interest to keep that quiet. And we've seen throughout his life that Joab will go to any lengths to protect David. He even murders his son when he wasn't supposed to. He kills David's son just to protect David. Joab will do anything. And so we've got it all contained, right? Everything's contained. No. There's another. If you're a Star Wars fan, right? When Yoda tells Luke, there is another. There is another who was watching at this moment in time. And so God sends Nathan to David. You know, we talk about Jonathan and David and their relationship and how close they were. But I got to be honest, Nathan is a good friend to David too. Because this is going to be something that is extremely difficult for Nathan to do, because coming to the king and telling him his sin is something that could probably in other circles lead to death. But Nathan goes anyway. Notice, starting in verse 1 of 2 Samuel 12, "Then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came and said to him, 'There were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished. It grew up together with him and his children. It would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. Then David's anger burned greatly against the man. And he said to Nathan, 'As the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die. He must make restitution for the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and had no compassion.'" Wow. Right? Don't you think this should have been enough for David to get it? Or at least to feel some sort or some sense of guilt? And maybe say, you know, maybe the circumstances surrounding this, maybe we ought to find out from this rich man and this poor man all of the circumstances, because maybe it was something, you know, beyond his control, right? At least have a little bit of sympathy for the guy, because David's got to be thinking, I did the same thing. Maybe not to a ewe lamb, but I've done this very thing. And to me, it is because David is so arrogant at this point in his life that he doesn't get it. Like we tease all the time as preachers, the times that you get done with a lesson, and I realize again there are circumstances surrounding certain of these comments, but you get done and somebody comes up to you and says, "Oh, I am so glad that so and so was there to hear this. They really needed that." And sometimes we can't hold up the mirror. And so, you know what, I needed that one. I've struggled in those circumstances and in those instances. I needed that. I believe David's arrogance is great here, to the point that he can't see it. And starting in verse 7, Nathan has to come out and tell David. "Nathan then said to David, 'You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel. It is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. I also gave you your master's house, your master's wives into your care. And I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have added to you more things like these. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife.'" Notice what the charge is here. The charge is you have despised the commandment of the Lord. He doesn't necessarily talk about the sin against Bathsheba, the sin against Israel as a nation, the sin against Uriah the Hittite. He said, "You've despised the commandment of the Lord. Look at all the things that God says I would have given you. I would have given you anything. If all the things that I had given you weren't enough, I would have given you more had you just asked. But again, you decided to go out and take it on your own." Look at Jeremiah chapter 3. We understand the sympathy maybe that God has, not only for Uriah the Hittite, but for Israel as a nation. In Jeremiah 3, starting in verse 6, "Then the Lord said to me, 'In those days, in the days of Josiah the king, have you seen what faithless Israel did? She went up on every high hill and under every green tree, and she was a harlot there. I thought, after she had done these things, she will return to me, but she did not return. And her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And I saw that for all the adulteries of faithless Israel, I sent her away and given her a writ of divorcement. Yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear, but she went and was a harlot also. Because of the lightness of her harlotry, she polluted the land and committed adultery with stones and trees. Yet in spite of all of this, her treacherous sister Judah did not return to me with all her heart, but rather in deception, declares the Lord. See, God considers Israel a harlot, an adulteress, in their relationship. And so we understand how God looks at that, and looks at David, and looks at Uriah, and looks at Bathsheba, and says, why? God offered everything to David, even though he didn't have to. And David says, it's not enough. God says, I offer you everything. And if that would have been too little, I would have offered you more. But it wasn't enough for David. Finally, let's look at the consequences of David's sin. Now, again, the consequence of physical adultery in Israel was death. Notice David himself pronounced that on the man in Nathan's story. He says, surely as the Lord lives, this man deserves to die. And in the response that Nathan gives to David, it is implied that death was understood to be the punishment. Again, if you look at verse 13, then David said to Nathan in 2 Samuel 12, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord has also taken away your sin. You shall not die. However, because this deed you have done has given occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born to you shall surely die. What a horrible thing to have to go through. David's life was spared, but the consequences of David's sin were not spared. And I'm sure that if you would ask David in this example, if you would ask David, he would probably switch places with that child, like any parent would do. Maybe more of the punishment for David was remaining alive while the child died. Because I'm sure David would have said, no, Lord, it was my sin. Let me die and spare the child's life. Again, in 2 Samuel 12, 5 and 6, David's anger burned greatly against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die. He must make restitution for the lamb fourfold, because he did this thing and had no compassion. This man will die, and he needs to restore fourfold. Well, David's life was spared. But in David's own response to this story, this lamb still needed to be restored, did it not? Well, let's take a look at how David restores. The first, the child with Bathsheba dies, just as God said that it would. He says he will surely die, and then in 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 18, we find that the child died. Then it happened on the seventh day that the child died. And again, it happens on the seventh day. What happens the eighth day? Circumcision, right? Male child, eighth day, circumcised. Didn't even get to that point. Taken away before that. Seventh day, the child died, and the servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child was dead. For they said, behold, while the child was still alive, we spoke to him and he did not listen to our voice. How then can we tell them that the child is dead, since he might do himself harm? Remember, fourfold, that was David's own judgment. We find the child number two, Amon, is killed by his brother Absalom because of the sin that was committed with Tamar, his sister. 2 Samuel 13:28-29. Absalom commanded his servants, saying, "See now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, to then put him to death. Do not fear, I have myself commanded you. Be courageous and valiant." The servants of Absalom did to Amnon just as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and each mounted his mule and fled. We find then Absalom being killed, as we mentioned earlier, by Joab, really to spare, again, David's life, whom David, if you would ask, would switch places with his son in a heartbeat. "Oh, Absalom, Absalom," David says. 2 Samuel 18:14-15, "Then Joab said, 'I will not waste time here with you.' So he took three spears in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom and killed him." Finally, as David is getting ready to die, Adonijah tries to overtake the throne, tries to take the throne from David that was rightly given to Solomon, his son. And so Adonijah tries to do this, overcome this. Bathsheba comes to David, tells David what's going on. And then we realize that as David is dying, that Solomon, his son, who would become king, has Adonijah put to death. In 2 Kings chapter 2 and verse 24. "Now therefore, as the Lord lives, who has established me and set me on the throne of David, my father, and who has made me a house as he promised, surely Adonijah shall be put to death today." We find that David, throughout his lifetime, paid back fourfold for that one little ewe lamb that he had taken. And it was by his own judgment God spared his life. But he offered back fourfold what he had taken. We cannot sin and then assume that we're not going to have consequences for it. Again, some of these things are punishments by God, but we can't assume that the consequences are not going to be there, of our sin are not going to be there. And we'll talk a little bit about some of those consequences tonight as well, as this thing remained on David's heart for the remainder of his life. This is so tragic, right? We find David's sin, and David is convicted of that sin. Not that he's convicted in his heart necessarily to change at that moment, but that he's literally convicted of his sins. He's deemed guilty of that sin. And we find that there were some dire consequences. And I want us to understand that these things hold true for us today as well. That our desires are what cause us to sin. And we have to be careful about those desires and what positions that we put ourselves in. Because we are going to be held accountable just in the same way that David was held accountable for his sin. And there will be consequences to those sins. But here's the good news. And I encourage you to come back tonight, because tonight is the good news. We look at how he was able to be found again after being so lost. Think about the highs and lows of David and his life. Think about how low he was when Saul was trying to kill him, right? And the high of becoming king and bringing, you know, the kingdom together into one and reigning for so long. And then the low of committing that sin in his life and having that weigh on him for the rest of his life. But we'll see tonight the high of being able to be restored to God once again. If you're here this morning and you're not a child of God, we haven't talked a lot about how to become a child of God, but understand that the offer is there for us. That we can become children of God through baptism into Jesus Christ for the remission of our sins. And we can begin that journey, that path, headed in the right direction. If you're here and you're a child of God who has fallen away, who's allowed sin to enter into their lives, and that sin has not yet been removed. Hopefully we don't need someone like Nathan to come to us and say, Tony, you're the guy in the story. It's you. That we can recognize that and recognize our loving God who would do anything and has done for us so that we can have a hope of eternal life with Him. We can make those things right with our God this very morning. Ask God to forgive us of those sins and then try to go from this moment and do what God would have us to do. If you're here and subject to God's call in any way, won't you please come to the front while we stand and while we sing?